This is episode number 3 with principal of Saison Capital, Chia Jing Young. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Senduk, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur, and in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, understand what investors really want to see in entrepreneurs, and give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, guys, beautiful people, we are back with another episode and I am pumped. I'm thrilled. I'm excited to join Chia Jing Young, our main man from Saison Capital, for a bit of a discussion today. Chia is a man of many talents, I would say, right? Loving mountains, loving hiking, used to be an operator, and now you jumped into the investment space as a principal at Saison Capital. Chia, what's happening, man? How's life?
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Andrew. It's a great time to be here. I think right before we start this session, we're just talking about how there's so much activity going on in Southeast Asia right now. It's going absolutely crazy. Every single time you think you're hitting a new inflection point, it's another milestone, the bigger milestone to reach. So it's been good. It's been really busy in the kind of startup environment right now. Really optimistic about what we're seeing and the great founders that we're working with. And I'm really pumped to be alive right now.
That is good. Being pumped to be alive. I'm with you on that. Chia, let's just jump into it, man. I was just reading an article on venture capital funding globally and said in 2018, 2019, there was about 250 or 300 billion funded into startups. And of that amount, maybe 60% of that amount was only in the US, only in the US. And the rest was scattered all over the world, right? And I think as a bridge of what you just was saying, you know, a lot of big rounds. I was just reading that CCHIP had just raised like 170 or something. What's your take, man? What's your take on the region when we talk about specifically Southeast Asia, funding going on, the maturity of the VC scene, the venture capital scene in Southeast Asia, still pretty early. What's your outlook for the coming years when we talk specifically about the funding space?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of interesting things that are happening. I think the first is certainly that the quality of talent that is willing to move into the startup space has significantly increased. And it's not just overseas talent who are attracted by stories they hear about Southeast Asia. It's also local junior talent who see, you know, joining a startup is not really the risky thing to do anymore. It's also senior executives who maybe, you know, spent the past 15 years in a big company and now willing to make that jump from, you know, traditional banking, traditional FMCG, and build companies. And so I think the talent side of the equation is really dramatically increased. And Andrew, obviously, you're a huge veteran of the space. I think you probably have lost stories yourself about what the startup scene was like, a long time ago. And I think at the same time, we see quite a lot of capital really develop for the ecosystem, both on the early stage and also increasingly on the later stage side of things, where you have, I think it's easier than ever before for you to go out there, raise a seed round, test out a hypothesis and build a company with fairly smart, experienced people. And so you see a lot of competition on that side popping up. You see a lot of seed funds, you know, run by folks from the US even coming here, setting up shop. You see the mafia from Rocket Internet, from Grab, Gojek, Lazada, Shopee, et cetera, really pop out to continue helping some of the ex-colleagues build companies in the region. And so I think that ecosystem maturing is something that we're really, really excited about. We see quite a lot of great founders pop up from that. And we also see, I think, even more activity from the later stage investors. So a lot of growth stage folks who have been here, some of them have been here for a while, you know, like KKRs, your NASPERs, your GBs, who have been increasingly looking at Southeast Asia, looking at Asia in general, and deploying checks. I've in the past 6 months have had tons of conversations with funds who are deploying their first large growth checks from Europe, from the US, and really trying to take the time, hire a team, understand the region. So I think there's a seriousness of capital, both on early and the later stage side of things, that are really supporting this new generation of talent.
Yeah, that's so awesome, right? From a macroeconomic perspective, you kind of like feel that cash is coming in, people are looking or eyeballing the region. So I think that's really, really amazing for the ecosystem. So one side of the spectrum is cash. The other side of the spectrum is investment opportunities, right? Quote unquote, yeah. fundable startups, fundable founders. And I think what you said there is a really good one on the quality of people that are entering the startup industry is actually now bigger, number one, and the quality is also getting much better, right? But when we talk about fundable startups, and I think you said something which is interesting, where you say like, okay, now is a good time to raise a seed round. Do you think that even now, like as we speak in this season right now, that it would be quote unquote easy or easier to raise a seed round and you know get your startup rolling? Or is there for specifically seed stage startups, or is it kind of challenging as well?
I think that it is actually, you know, relatively easy to raise a seed round. Of course, that's not applicable for everyone. And obviously there's a lot of hype in media about, you know, some of the more popular founders perhaps raising larger rounds than we've ever seen before, you know, your 5 to 10 mil seed rounds, you know, based off nothing, because of kind of their pedigree and their experience.
Exactly.
And of course, I think you'll also find a lot of founders who might struggle to raise a seed round, even in kind of the context of what I'm talking about. I think some of the nuances that have to be teased apart is that the standard certainly has been raised a little bit. I think that, you know, when we look at competition for seed capital into the business models, there is a lot of nuances that are prevalent in, for example, let's take Indonesia as a specific example, where, you know, I think 10 years ago when Rocket Internet, I think, was more popular, and I was from Rocket Internet, it was more straightforward to copy some of these business models, hey, look, you know, general e-commerce, right? Like nothing super complicated to replicate. We just need to execute well.
Yeah.
And so if you go out there and you have a great pedigree and you're doing a general e-commerce, that's fine, right? And I think that now it's very different because the ecosystem is very, very different from other parts of the world, right? If we take e-commerce, if we take fintech, if we take the dynamics and existing infrastructure is not zero. So we're not copying playbooks from scratch anymore. We do have to develop our own ways of understanding the local ecosystem, of building unique business models.
Yeah.
And I look at India as a good example of that, where a couple of business models are now super successful, like Baiju and Udaan. And there's no real comparable to Udaan and Baiju anywhere else around the world. Udaan is not really Alibaba, for example, because it's mostly domestic, and Baiju has no comp. And so I think one of the things that perhaps gets missed a little bit is that when we think about business models that are fundable, some of them can be copied, and we've seen some of that, but some others can't simply be copied, and it takes a lot of that information dredging, talking to a lot of folks around the world to really understand that. And so sometimes I think that discrepancy is why you have founders who are, you know, raising huge rounds right from the beginning, and sometimes you have founders who are trying to copy certain business models and not understanding why there might not be interest from investors. And so I think sometimes you see that dynamic happening.
Yeah, those are I love that, man, because it kind of shows as well that the landscape is evolving, right? Where, let's say 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, early Rocket times, e-com is just e-com. We just sell stuff. I mean, that's kind of like the main use, right? But now it gets more sophisticated. There's more domestic IP. There's more domestic IP, more domestic developed like ideas that are really now shape the world, at least in this region, which is amazing, because it shows actually also the growth and maturity in the industry, right? To talk about like,
life as an operator, and you mentioned Rocket for a while. You mentioned Rocket briefly as well. I mean, you've been an operator as well. What's been your journey from operator into, you know, what made you move into the investment space after being, you know, after having been exposed to getting your hands dirty as an operator, especially at Rocket? What's been your thinking pattern?
Yeah, I still miss it, to be honest. I still, you know, maybe people don't see the side of me, but I still try to consider myself as operator. I still try to work as closely as I can with founders to understand really minute operational details. And I was helping to set up, you know, e-commerce operations and logistics, 3PL management, warehouse setup, that whole shebang. And I think what I was trying to optimize for during that time is really to learn as much as I could. Mm. And there came a point when I was hanging out with some friends in Sri Lanka and I was telling them about e-commerce operations, and they looked at me and they were like, just keep quiet. Like, this is not interesting at all. And so I realized, like, I enjoyed learning that, but no one else cared about that knowledge. And so that made me realize, okay, you know, I want to keep learning more things. I think I'm maybe being a bit siloed in this specific field. And so talked to a bunch of friends who are in VC, and I thought I was really attracted by their ability to look at multiple business models, learn across the board, and really, you know, to a certain small extent, pick and choose what they wanted to learn. Yeah. And that was really attractive to me. And so that's kind of how I went down that VC route, and, you know, being involved in that side of things.
Yeah. And what's been the biggest, like, takeaway now? I mean, how long have you been now on the investment side?
Let's call it 2-3 years.
2-3 years. So what's been, like, your biggest takeaway, say the biggest learning so far, and the biggest difference between, you know, getting your hands dirty and building from scratch?
Yeah, I think you really do care about very different things on the VC side of it, because one of the unfortunate truths about venture capital is that it's really, at the end of the day, about being able to build towards a vision which is relatively game-changing.
Mm.
And that's a very different mindset from being an operator, where you are trying to figure out solutions to things.
Mm.
And I particularly like backing very ex-COOs, ex-operators, as opposed to kind of more CEO type people, because I tend to love to dive into, like, how are you solving this problem? And when you talk to COOs, like, they can go on for hours. This is how I'm solving problem A, this is how I'm solving problem B, this is how I'm solving problem C. But sometimes that's not necessarily what investors want to hear. They want to be able to hear, look, the vision of this industry and how it changes is this, right? We will solve it vaguely through this mechanism. Just give us a ton of money and we will solve it. We'll figure the rest out, right?
Yeah.
But the message I'm communicating to you is that our vision is this big, right? And sometimes when you're an operator, you're more concerned about, look, let's not deal with problem B until we figure out how we can solve problem A.
Yeah.
Then we'll talk about the rest, right? And so you have a little bit of that difference going on. Obviously, it's not mutually exclusive, but it's a very interesting distinction I see sometimes. And obviously, if you have a founder who can do both really well, and thankfully we do, you get something really, really fantastic at that point.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's powerful, right? As startup founders versus, let's say, investors, the one is caring for his or her baby and just making sure that this baby is going to grow into a healthy adult, right? As an investor, at the end of the day, you're managing assets, right? You're managing funds, and you want to return as best as you can the money. Is there sometimes a tension between what you want as an investor and, let's say, bottom line? You know, if we should really describe it black and white, you want to have a higher return for your LPs. And of course, at the same time, by doing that, choosing, of course, the right entrepreneurs, the right ideas that will change the world. But the bottom line of that changing the world is also to give back to the LP, right? And the entrepreneur itself, of course, growth for the entrepreneur is extremely important. The time span in which that growth occurs could be different than what the investor wants. Do you find that sometimes difficult to find, like, how do you call that? Like a middle ground in that, where at one side, yes, you want to optimize your return for your LPs, but at the same side, you also want to quote unquote make the growth of the portfolio company sustainable instead of this, you know, hyper growth or growth at all costs type of approach. Is that sometimes difficult as an investor to navigate around those two different needs that you're representing?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I would say there's definitely tension. And I think we've definitely heard of plenty of examples that where the tension has resulted in negative things. Also, sometimes, you know, there's a great outcome for everyone involved. So that's also good. I think that there are fundamentally, if you look at incentives, two main problems that exist. And when you solve those two main problems, you solve that tension. And the first problem is alignment between the founder and the VC about what type of business built, right? I see plenty of businesses where I go, that's amazing, you're amazing, like this is great, I wish I was you, but I can't invest as a from the VC fund. And I think that's completely okay, and I think that that should be understood between the founder and the VC. And sometimes the VC is not communicating that upfront, or sometimes the founders might misunderstand the incentives of VCs. Increasingly less common, because I think we're all getting more mature and educated about the space, still sometimes exists. The second part of it is also, you know, the VCs are driven by the type of LPs that they have. And so, you know, we also have more mature LPs, for example, in other ecosystems where they tend to understand certain type of investments and the way it drives returns. And so I think sometimes VCs are driven to do that because maybe they haven't had that experience that there are multiple ways to get a great return. And actually right before this podcast, I was reading about the story of Zapier, who raised $150,000 out of YC, a bunch of small investors, and they didn't raise a single round after that for basically 7 years.
Yeah.
$5 billion company.
Wow, man. Those are...
I would love to be the founder or the early investor, right? You've clearly made quite a lot of money in that. And and I think that kind of attitude only comes when the VC themselves maybe have more experience, a little bit more patient, and there is a path that we can see based on some of the macro environment, right? So, you know, just to sum it all up, there is that tension. I think it exists. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the first is alignment between the VC and the founder, alignment between the LPs and the VCs, and also the market condition that we operate in.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense, man. That's a really good example. So to start, what was the name of the startup you mentioned? The 150K
Zapier.
One? Zapier. Oh, Zapier. Oh, really? Did it 115K after Y? Ycom?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's amazing. I didn't know that, man. What an amazing story. I use them. That's amazing.
Yeah.
but that's a really good one, right? So you actually want to back companies that don't need your money. I mean, from a perspective of, you guys are already making money. You know how to manage your P&L. You know how to manage your bottom line. Apparently, you know how to manage growth without me giving you money, without you needing my money to actually grow the business. You're doing well. Of course, before, as we're talking about like a couple of years back, the money raised with VCs or PEs in general, the money raised was usually used for customer acquisition or a big chunk of it. And then I refer to e-com, of course, mostly, but I think when you drill down in all those different fundraisers, I think a lot of the money was used to acquire customers left or right. Are you being more selective now when it comes to that type of fundraising? Where, of course, I think any fundraise nowadays would say, okay, a portion of our fundraise, we're going to use it for customer acquisition. But is it now, because the market is also evolving and the growth at all cost strategy is not really what the market wants or what investors want to do, that you become more selective when it comes to, you know, okay, we want to raise this chunk of money, only this small portion of that money will go to customer acquisition? Are you more selective when it comes to those type of fundraisers, and that you really want to know where the money goes in that sense?
Gotcha. No, I think that's a good question. Actually, small clarification, they raised 1.4 million, okay. which is 10 times more than I expected, yeah.
But yeah, still,
obviously still great.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, I think it really depends on the foundation that you are building with that acquisition. And so I think for a lot of, and we'll take e-commerce as an example, a lot of e-commerce plays, some of them were less successful because that type of flywheel effect on the brand and repeat purchasing didn't really materialize.
Exactly.
Whereas some other type of flywheel in food delivery, for example, did materialize. I remember, you know, looking at some of the CAC involved for food delivery a long time ago, and I was just mind blown. How could this make sense? And I, as you can see from the additional weight that I've gained, you know, I'm a power user for food delivery, and I understand that now, right? Because it's like, I'm so educated about this, about food delivery, that I can't not use it.
Yeah.
And and so I think that narrative about what you're using the, what you're burning that acquisition cost on really, really matters.
Yeah.
Which is why we kind of go back to what, you know, what's the vision that you're building?
Yeah.
Are you merely acquiring it just to leak afterwards? Or are you acquiring that because there's a, at the very least, a good story about what that flywheel and fundamental foundation is?
Yeah, agree. It's I think with investing and startups, at the end of the day, the holistic approach should make sense, right? The whole thing should make sense. That's a good one, because when I read stories about, for example, like WeWork, right, which was massive, you know, which was the golden boy, and the golden boy turned into quote unquote a loser, right? What is your take on that when it comes to, you know, because the backers of WeWork were, of course, I mean, the biggest guns in the market, right? Where you would expect or assume that exactly what you just said, you know, where an investor, I look at this investment opportunity from a holistic perspective. I look at it from a P&L perspective. Of course, you do your due diligence. What do you think went wrong there? Like, is it misleading from the entrepreneur side? Is it misinterpreting from the investor side? Or like, what's kind of your take on that?
I think a lot of people are probably guilty of something. A lot of different stakeholders are probably guilty of something in the whole kind of WeWork specific example. I would probably say this. I think, you know, just using your terms on looking at things on a more holistic level.
Yeah.
One of the problems about that is that it's qualitative, and it's really hard to assess qualitative decisions. And for better or for worse, you know, in that specific example, for example, Masayoshi-san made billion-dollar decisions in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Right? And sometimes that pays off really well, obviously, in Alibaba, etc., where, you know, this is something that you can't tangibly understand. You still have to make big financial investment decisions really on the gut feel.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think, just to share, like, our approach that at least we try to think about it is that you can't fully understand everything about the world, and you will still have to rely and make some decisions on a bet.
Yeah.
But the very least you can do is continue to improve the way that you think about the world so that you at least try to get closer and closer to the truth.
Yeah.
We'll never be able to claim that we'll always know the truth.
Yeah,
but we can at least claim that we have sharpened the tools to build a better gut feel about this, right? And so, you know, Snap is doing amazingly well. I still, you know, personally don't understand Snapchat.
Yeah.
But, you know, Snapchat brought this change in consumer behavior that the founders just kind of understood, whereas WeWork didn't bring that change in consumer behavior that the founders and investors felt that they understood, right? And not to say that one is worse or not, but it was really, you know, indicative of just sometimes how hard it is to make these types of bets.
Yeah, yeah. How would you describe yourself, right? If you would name, let's say, three elements that need to be checked. I mean, for you as an investor, you see, you know, hundreds, thousands of pitch decks every year. What are for you the three main characteristics that you look at in a deck or in a founder for you to say pass to the next stage?
Yeah, I think the first thing, it's definitely somebody who knows who deeply understands how an industry really functions, or at least has the ability to learn about the inner workings of an industry very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I think all the founders that we've backed really understand that, and you can ask them a single small question about the industry and they can go on and on about this happened first and this happened and then you can't forget this thing and then that there's that stakeholder and then secret deal happened, etc. So that industry understanding, I think, is really key. The second, I think, is really being able to hire and sell above you know what you expect them to, and I think that's especially crucial in Southeast Asia, where talent is obviously a very hard thing to come by. I think the last one for us definitely is integrity, and that's something that we care quite a lot about, which I think is also fairly standard. But I would say those are the three things that we really kind of care about.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting because I think when you're on the founder side or entrepreneur side, you care, of course, a lot about P&L. You should care a lot about P&L. You should care a lot about economics. But I think the last one you said is crucial as well, just being a good person, right? I mean, just integrity on how you do business. And I think, of course, also from a business concept perspective, it should overflow integrity, I think, from a personal perspective. But I think also as a company, those values should be very clear. I think that's something which sometimes it's maybe overlooked. At least when I personally look at how we fundraised, it's not per se something that we highlighted per se. But it's a good point, man. And how would you say that from a fund perspective? I mean, you say integrity is important, but then you also add like, but that's maybe general, that's maybe standard. Like everyone would maybe looking at that. From a fund perspective, there's a lot of funds out there, right? And if I would categorize all the funds and what every fund says on their website or what they stand for, it's kind of like we back amazing founders that are changing the world and we're going to help you do that. Like that's kind of like if there's one bucket I could really like categorize these funds in, there's like one bucket, and that one bucket would say that, you know, we back amazing founders that are shaping industries or developing technologies that are changing the world. How would you say that you as a fund are differentiating yourself or are different than the other funds out there?
Yeah, no, good question. Thanks for the opportunity to answer this question. So I think we look at it from three main differentiators. So number one, and one thing that we really care about, is that everyone in our investment team has either been an operator or a founder before. And for us, that was really important. It took me a year to hire my team because we cared so much about that. And number two, we are also much more, we invest on a multi-stage and also multi-asset class basis. So, you know, we do pre-seed to Series B. And so we have, you know, a wide set of tools. We invest across multiple geographies.
Yeah,
Singapore, Southeast Asia, India, and a little bit in the US, because we care a lot about trying to understand different nuances and best practices about different industries, different geographies, and the business models that went on there. And you know, one of the things that we talk about internally is like, you know, India is maybe 3 to 5 years ahead of Southeast Asia, so we need to learn about what's going on there.
Yeah.
And in the US, you know, it's maybe, you know, 5 to 10 years ahead, and so we need to learn about what's going on there. So, you know, we try to learn about the US to be competitive as we can in India.
Yeah.
And we try to learn about India to try to be as competitive as we can in Southeast Asia. And so that's something that we care about. And we also multi asset class, so we invest across LP investments. So we work with a lot of VC funds. And so we also invest across, you know, wholesale debt, and of course, you know, growth equity, direct equity. And so I think we have quite a lot of information flow that comes to us that maybe people are not aware of, and we like to keep it that way. And so, you know, we get to see it quite a lot actually, and try to bring that lesson. And then maybe the last thing super quickly is, given how much information that we use and we try to really come at it from a very structured approach. I think we'll talk to you about, you know, some of the qualitative approaches.
Mm.
We spend a lot of time building investment frameworks, and we're not shy to put out our investment thesis out there, where we take the time, write it on the weekends, push it out there. Founders, investors, if you think that it makes sense, let's have a chat. If you think it's shit, you can publicly criticize it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have that framework. It's out there. This is how we think. You know?
Yeah.
And we want that to be a reflection of kind of that's the depth and complexity and the structure of which we take conversations with founders.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's really awesome. So you can really help the founders from a much bigger perspective than just, okay, I'm going to write you a check. Here you go. Bye bye. There's operational experience. There's a global backing, actually, right? And then whole ecosystem, actually, because if you talk about different asset classes or even like, you know, funds of funds, and there's so much network which comes then with that, which is pretty powerful, man. When you talk about the last 2-3 years that you've been on the investment side, could you share maybe, I don't know if you can or if it's confidential or not, but from an experience, what has been, let's say, the deal that you've been most proud of that you worked on? Is it something that you could share, and why? Could be from an experience. Could also be from a return.
I love all our portfolio companies equally.
That's a very good answer. That's a very good answer.
Terrible question, Andrew. I really don't think I have kind of a single deal that's my favorite deal. Generally enjoy working with everyone. I think it's been a pretty great fun. I think what I can say is this, just to tell stories, I think because we work with some of our companies that kind of like the early stage in the kind of pre-seed, et cetera, it does not compare to the founders' experiences, of course, but, you know, we also have our own anxiety about how certain portfolio companies may be performing. And, you know, the feedback loop is very long, right? And so while founders may have, you know, I think some people describe it as like the great delusional optimism that they will always do well. And obviously but in truth, the mental stress is way more than founders than investors, sometimes investors have that stress too. Right. And, you know, being able to see some of those companies grow way faster than you thought was possible to get validation, et cetera, I think that journey sometimes happens very fast in a very short time frame of time. Sometimes it will take a really, really long time, right?
Yeah.
But you'll get there, right? Somehow it just happens. You get there, everything seems to work all at once. And, you know, hanging on and you know, keeping the faith and being there when it actually really goes well, I think is something that means a lot to me. Obviously, it means way more to the founder, but I'm really privileged to be like part of that roller coaster.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's awesome, man. It brings more perspective as well, right? I mean, again, coming back to just giving money, it's almost like, coming back to the parable of, you know, it's like a quote unquote baby or a seed that you're trying to take care of. And then, you know, whether it's raining or the sun is shining, you're kind of like helping them along the way, right? What would you say is one of the most common myths within the VC space or investing space that people think is true, but it's not? Because when you talk about VCs, when you talk about investing, it's a lot of cowboy, big money, you know, you guys are writing checks of, you know, smallest, maybe 500 grand, 500,000 US up to millions of dollars, right? So you manage money of very high net worth individuals or, you know, or institutions. It's a big money game, right? So with that big money comes a lot of pressure, and people outside of the space, outside of the VC space, for sure are thinking like, okay, these guys are like cowboys, man, with their big checkbooks, writing checks here and there. But you're in there. Like, what would you say after 2-3 years? What's been your, this is not what I thought that it would be.
Yeah. So that's actually one that I am quite passionate to talk about, which is, I think, something that should be said a lot more, but isn't, and it harms founders. And let me set the foundation for this. VC is an asset class where, you know, they're investing into companies early on, and then they want those companies to raise follow-on funding, and they want those companies to eventually be big, get PE money, go IPO, et cetera. And so what that means is there's this financial ladder of, you know, VC selling to growth equity, selling to PE, selling to, to the public markets, which means that everyone is very incentivized to create the same narrative about what is going to be successful so that it goes into the public markets, it becomes a great company, et cetera, et cetera. And we see that as basically hype, a bubble about a specific space. And so sometimes when certain things are hot, you see VCs flooding in, pouring money into that space because they might have heard in a different region, this works really well.
Yes.
And so let's build this clone, right?
Yeah.
And all of them decide all at once, okay, let's do this. I think two things. Number one, that VC attention may not necessarily mean that the business model is great. And so founders would be persuaded to kind of build that really because it's, oh, I heard it's hot.
And yeah.
It is important to for everyone to be building within the hot space because, you know, that's how you quickly make your returns.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I think is actually a little bit dangerous is if you're not in the loop on the pulse of certain business models in real time, what might come across with certain founders is, oh, you know, 6 months ago, I've been reading about this. It's really hot. Let me launch this business model.
Yeah.
Because, well, it was hot just 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, definitely must be interesting still, right? So let me build this clone.
Yeah.
And so you have hype bubbles, which actually end sometimes in months or sometimes in weeks, right? Oh, this new news came out. Actually, this business model is not exciting anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have the founder who's like, wait a minute, like, 2 weeks ago, you'd say this was super interesting.
Yeah.
Now you're saying it's not interesting. Like, what's going on, right?
Yeah.
Like, nothing has changed about the business. The business is still the business, right? So I think sometimes you hear, you know, a lot about stuff like that and it really, like, hurts founders. And for me, like, I think that's such a shame and a waste because, you know, it's nothing. The founder did everything right. And sometimes it just isn't good enough to go down that VC route.
So interesting, because I think when you mentioned the word hype, there's been a lot of hypes, man. There's been a lot of hypes. but at the same time, I think hype is such a human, it's human nature, right? Where there's a hype people will go to. And I think investors in that sense are also sensitive for that, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's human behavior. And where companies flock to or where investors flock to, it kind of like attracts, right? But it also shows that there's hype on one side, but at the other side, there's just, is your business a real business or not? Apart from hype, yes or no, are the economics, do they make sense? So I think Zapier is a really good example. Okay, you know, for sure they raised $1 million+, which is still very decent. But then, and I love this type of stories because I think these type of stories need to be highlighted much more in today's world. Because sometimes I think a lot of founders or startup entrepreneurs, they kind of like live towards fundraisers. And it's almost like these fundraisers are the accolades or the you know, the mentions that they wanna share, where actually it's a Zapier type of business models where, you know, we raise one time to get things going, to get maybe the initial traction. But after that, every year, 10%, 25% maybe, and just keep doing that. And I think that's also one of the things, like, I don't know what your thoughts are about quote unquote hyper growth versus just compound every year or every month, just, you know, a couple of percent, 10%+, 20%+ every year, then you get there as well. Like, what is your idea when we talk about growth, for example, right? And talk about hypes, because usually a hype is because there is a peak in growth somewhere or a peak in demand. Like, from an investor perspective, like, what would your, I don't know, what are your takes about hyper growth on the concept of hyper growth? Is it something that you believe in or something that you're against, or what are your thoughts about that?
The way I look at that is it's one way to make money sometimes. And there are many other ways to make money. And so you should kind of have eyes wide open if you're choosing a particular path and have a conviction that that path works for what you're doing. And, you know, if you look at companies like Stamped, which just got acquired in Singapore, you know, 100 mil founder never raised VC money. Right. So he's obviously doing really well.
Yeah.
Another company that I love is Calendly, which is, I think, 5 billion. Again, you know, the founder has done tons of interviews where he was talking about how he got rejected by every single VC.
Yeah.
Eventually raised from a VC that no one had heard of and raised only, I think, $1 million. Wow. And now he's like 5 billion also, right?
Wow.
So absolutely, I think that it's just one way to make money. It's one way to make money that a lot of people talk about.
Yeah.
And might not be the best fit for everyone. And that's completely fine.
Right? Yeah.
I think everyone.
Yeah. No, no, for sure, man. I think maybe that also comes with the maturing of the industry and also the maturing on the VC side, by the way, where, you know, people are looking further than, you know, the famous hockey stick curve, right? just a quick one, like your life as an investor, right? Like, how would you describe your day, like from the moment you wake up until you go to bed? Like, are you like looking at decks the whole day and then on calls with portfolio companies? Like, what is kind of like your jam?
Yeah, it's a mix. I think the great thing is that no 2 days are the same.
That's good.
I'm, you know, dealing with our team, dealing with our portfolio founders, dealing with new investment opportunities and, you know, other stakeholders. And so every day is just a little bit of a mix of things. I think the only stable thing is that on Wednesdays, I take half a day to not meet people.
That's good.
And that's the only semi-consistent thing that I've done so far. So it's really a mix, I think. You know, you can't really anticipate when someone needs anything. I think the worst, quote unquote, worst one was kind of, I was helping, not worst, but kind of the most interesting one was kind of hopping on calls with founders until like 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we had to get deliverable out. And so I think that's, you know, not something I woke up expecting to do that day. So that was great.
Yeah, but it keeps, okay. So, but I mean, your life as an investor is actually very diverse, right? I mean, it's from the just getting the pitch deck up until operational, like really being involved in helping the founders to build a business, right? That is that's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Keeps it vibrant.
Yeah, for sure.
And what do you think is the best part of your job?
I think one thing I'm definitely very thankful and privileged for is that I get to spend time thinking about the future of different industries.
Yeah.
And I essentially get paid a little bit to be as creative as I want to be.
Yeah.
Within the business context. And somehow writing is part of my job, which I'm also like very thankful for, because I don't think anyone else would get paid to spend time thinking and writing. So I really appreciate that part of the job.
That's awesome, man. We fast forward, right? As we come to a close of the session, we fast forward to the future, where if I Google Chia, there's no Medium. There's no Medium articles. There's no personal website. There's no Saison Capital. I don't find anything about you, actually. But the only thing I find about you, or people can find about you, are three lessons, are three life lessons. What would those three life lessons be, Chia?
Maybe to be a bit cliched, I think the one thing that the first thing would be, you know, always be paranoid. I think
always be
that's
paranoid.
A lesson. Oh yeah, always be paranoid.
Explain.
I think one of the reasons I went into tech was because I was paranoid that a legal career, which is what my undergrad was, would be eaten up by AI. That's a true story, actually.
That's really good, man.
Yeah, so I was like, you know, I don't want to be useless in 30 years. And so let's go into tech. This tech thing seems to make a lot of sense.
Mm.
And you know, you take that paranoia and you apply that to the job that you have, to the firm that you're working at. And, you know, you try to future-proof a lot of this as far as possible. And I think that brings you closer and closer to doing something innovative, to being at the cutting edge.
Yeah.
So I like to think that we've done some of that pretty well. So I think, yeah, always be paranoid. It's definitely something that I think it's super important. The second thing, which I wish I definitely am more, is try to be as nice as possible. I definitely, maybe I'm not the nicest person all the time. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, we're all human beings, you know, living our time on earth until we die. And so more kindness and friendliness from everyone, you know, just makes sense.
For sure.
And yeah, I think that maybe the last thing that I can think of is really just spend time in as many directions as possible, and always kind of look at things from a more broad and, as you mentioned, holistic view. Mm. And so I think my Facebook page, for example, is just a bunch of completely unrelated topics from history to military stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you added me on Facebook, so you know.
Of course, man. I know everything.
It's all a bunch of like really weird, unrelated things.
Really random posts.
Yes. I like that kind of like variety in life, and so that for me is
I love it, man. I love it, man. So number one is be paranoid, and my translation of being paranoid would be to keep innovating and not be. To be content, maybe, but not settled. You know, I think there's a lot of people who maybe say like, oh, "Yeah, I'm happy and everything is good," but when you have an undergrad in law and you're already worrying about your job being taken over by technology, I think that's really progressive, man. that's really good. Number two is being kind, which I agree, man. We need more kindness in the world. And number three would be more like try to evolve yourself into different areas of life. And don't be just stuck to one niche, right? Don't be just stuck into, oh, this is my point of view and this is the only point of view. So look at it more from a holistic perspective. I love that, man. I love that, dude. I always like to end with appreciation of you. I thank you, well, one, for your time. But I really appreciate the fact that we got connected based off your article, and you're like really open to connect. And yeah. You know, the couple of times we were on a call, we've always been jamming out as if we know each other for years. But the truth of the matter is that we have not. But it's been always good to connect, whether it's with this through over Zoom or video or over the WhatsApp. Appreciate your time, dude. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing and opening up. I hope to see you soon in real life. That would be really nice to crack a coconut or open a beer. So hopefully that will happen soon, man. Thanks so much, Chia.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, dude.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please share this with a friend that you think would be inspired or could learn something from this. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Masters of Cashflow podcast over on Apple and Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review on Apple and let me know what your biggest takeaway is of this episode. I'm going to leave you with this quote from Robert H. Schuller. Tough times never last, but tough people do. And that's what I want to remind you of today, is that you are tough, and whatever season you're going through right now, keep on going. I'm super grateful for you. I wish you all the best in pursuing your dreams.